Hello, my friends, coming up on What's Bugging Me. We have a supply chain problem with conspiracy theories because all of them are coming true. The plot against President Trump, the fake controversy over secret documents, the Twitter files, and Kim Strassel joins us today, the star columnist for the Wall Street Journal. We'll talk about Jim Jordan and the Republicans, ready to investigate deep state and the weaponization of the U.S. government against thousands of Americans.
This is a government that has the ability to regulate, to tax, to fine, to penalize. And essentially, yes, they were threatening them.
Plus, trader Jim Yorio will tell us his outlook for stocks and bonds this year and why the Fed will stop raising rates pretty soon.
Part of the Fed's game plan was to destroy demand through higher rates and through destroying actual wealth. Their plan was to knock the froth out of the stock market, to knock the $3 trillion cryptocurrency market. That was really what they wanted to do.
And you'll get my counsel on how to stave off Alzheimer's by sleeping better. Drivers, start your engines. Salutations, my fellow Americans. So glad you are joining me for episode 6 of What's Bugging Me. The networks won't give me a show, so I created my own. Please like us and love us wherever you listen to this pod, and subscribe to the Ricochet channel on YouTube, where you can also catch some great video interviews and confirm that I have a face made for radio. So let's start today with conspiracy theories. What's bugging me is that so many of them are no longer theories at all anymore. They're undeniably true. Here's what's really bugging me about it, though. The FBI. On December 21st, the FBI responded to the Twitter files that had been out for 3 weeks by this time, and the FBI's response was incredibly arrogant and condescending to the American people. The FBI made fun of anyone who took seriously this rampant violation of First Amendment rights on Twitter. And the FBI put a statement, the statement said, quote, the men and women of the FBI work every day to protect the American public. It is unfortunate that conspiracy theorists and others are feeding the American public misinformation with the sole purpose of attempting to discredit the agency. How dare you? Unfortunate? Conspiracy theorists? And I got to tell you, this infuriated me. The arrogance of it. The FBI jeering, as if my getting upset about this government intrusion, I'm some guy in a tinfoil hat spouting conspiracy theories. How dare the FBI do this? How dare FBI Director Christopher Wray sanction this retort? Fire him, as I've said before. Now, Elon Musk, the new owner of Twitter, he told a scalding truth, and it's also kind of funny in a gallows humor kind of way. On Christmas Eve, December 24th, 3 days after the FBI's statement about conspiracy theories, Musk's at headquarters for Twitter, and he goes on one of my favorite podcasts, the All In podcast, hosted by Jason Calacanis. Bunch of smart guys on this thing. And Elon Musk says,
I mean, to be totally frank, almost every conspiracy theory that people had about Twitter turned out to be true. So, is there a conspiracy theory about Twitter that didn't turn out to be true? So far, they've all turned out to be true. And if not, more true than people thought.
Take that, FBI. Now, this week comes a spoon-fed scoop from pro-Democratic sources, clearly, to CBS News. Joe Biden's personal lawyers found top secret documents from his time as vice president locked away in a think tank. And this is against the federal documents law that the FBI is now using to go after Donald Trump in a criminal case. So prepare now for the rest of the media to bury this story as soon as they can, just as they have done with the Twitter files for more than a month now. They are shameless shills. It's a hashtag I wish we could make trend on Twitter, you know, to describe the media. Hashtag shameless shills. So anyway, let's recall that in the search for purloined top secret documents, when it came to Donald Trump, the FBI raided President Trump's home at Mar-a-Lago. They spent hours and hours there. They literally went through the lingerie drawer of the First Lady of the United States. The media stoked it like crazy before the midterm elections. Once again, the Trump haters felt like, we got him, we got him. And then, nothing. It turned out a lot of the documents were forgotten. They were locked up rather than even being sold to the Russians, as the Trump critics would have it. And Trump lawyers had been in talk with the feds for months about those documents. The only reason to do a raid was for political theater. So now it's Joe Biden's turn. As vice president, he lacked the presidential powers that Trump had to decree single-handedly these top secret documents no longer a secret. And the FBI knew that Joe Biden had his illegal top secret documents. So it's fewer than a dozen documents. He had it in the wrong place. The FBI knew this over 2 months ago before the midterm elections. But the FBI sure kept that quiet, didn't it? And so did the media, of course. They're telling us only now. Here's what Rachel Maddow, the ultra-liberal apologist for Biden on MSNBC, here's what Rachel Maddow had to say when the FBI searched the home of President Trump.
To get even more specific, what it means is that, you know, to get that warrant to search Trump's house in Florida, prosecutors had to prove to the satisfaction of a federal judge that there was probable cause to believe that at Trump's home, they would find evidence that that part of the Espionage Act had been violated, that that crime had been committed.
Ah, now for a totally different tone, here's that same supposed journalist, see air quotes around the word journalist, Rachel Maddow, shameless shill, liberal co-conspirator. Here's how she minimizes the Biden situation.
The White House says it is cooperating fully with the National Archives and with the Department of Justice on the review. And again, this was not, as it was in Trump's case, the archives desperately seeking the return of materials that Trump was blowing off. And Trump was blowing off those requests and then ultimately blowing off the subpoena to return all those documents. These appear to have been documents that were inadvertently held at the Penn Biden Center, discovered by Biden's attorneys. They notified the White House, which notified immediately the National Archives that these documents were in the wrong place. The archives moved immediately to retrieve them. That appears to be the sum total of it, at least as far as we know. But again, the White House says they are cooperating fully with the archives and with the Justice Department on reviewing the situation.
MSNBC, Rachel Maddow, all the major mainstream media outlets, their coverage all boils down to one message: Biden good, Trump bad. Even for liberals and Trump haters, this media bias against Donald Trump poses a problem. It makes Trump even more sympathetic to those who love him. All this negative media coverage, this biased coverage so blatantly and unashamedly aimed against President Trump, it creates Trump agonistes. It makes him a martyr. And that could win votes for him. And helping Trump in any way is the last thing the media want to do. And that also is why they have spent more than a month ignoring one of the biggest political and business scandals in decades, the Twitter files. I've been telling you about this story for 6 weeks now. I've written columns at Newsmax.com and TruthDAO, D-A-O, TruthDAO.news, telling you what the media won't. I've done more stories, as I said, than the entire staffs of the New York Times and the Washington Post combined. What are the media hiding? Have no fear, patriots. The new Republican majority of the House is coming to the rescue and preparing to investigate the Twitter files and the weaponization of the U.S. government on social media to silence thousands of Americans. How would I know? Because the great Kimberly Strassel of the Wall Street Journal told me so. Up next, she joins us to provide the very latest news on this very good thing.
Hey, James Lavick here, reminding you that just because the elections are over doesn't mean there's not stuff to talk about. There's lots. There's looking back at what happened. There's looking back at the stuff blowing up today and taking a look at the stuff that might be blowing up tomorrow. We'll talk about it all in the next Ricochet Flagship Podcast.
All right, Kim Strassel, one of the best political columnists anywhere, is going to join us now. She's been with the Journal close to 30 years now, and most of that time on the editorial board. Since 2005, she's been doing her weekly column, Potomac Watch, and she's been a regular on shows like Face the Nation and Meet the Press and lived to tell about it. And so it's an honor to have her come on, and I now owe her. Thanks for being with us, Kim. Now, first, just a zoom away, okay? In your entire career, or 5 years ago, you published a book titled The Intimidation Game, How the Far Left is Silencing Free Speech. Cut to today, did you ever imagine would go this far and be this sweeping?
No, not at all. And by the way, that book laid out a lot of things that I thought were very scary at the time, from IRS targeting that was going on to this John Doe case in Wisconsin to acts of intimidation against people because of their political views. But the notion at that time that social media companies would be coerced or team up with the government to actually censor entire areas of speech, whether it be COVID, whether it be the election, whether it be whether or not Trump should be banned from Twitter. I mean, it's remarkable to me. I've never seen anything like it. And the depth and the extent of it is what's most scary to me, Dennis.
It was so many agencies. At first, I thought just the FBI. Then we see the CIA is in there, and then the State Department and the Defense Department and dozens of state police agencies and dozens of state elections offices and NGOs and the Democratic National Committee and the Biden administration and congressmen, but also the Trump administration as well, right?
Well, right. And in the beginning, I think that's been some of the concerning aspects of this here, too, as we find out that it's equal opportunity. Now, look, I would note that a great deal of the censorship and the more pointed censorship has taken place under Democrats and under the Democratic administration. But we did have some evidence that, for instance, at the beginning of COVID, the Trump health team was reaching out and trying to make sure that only government doctors' views were the ones that were being circulated on social media, which is astonishing.
It is. And it is a direct prior restraint on free speech. I mean, they had government agents in there had Twitter censor even tweets that were merely quoting publicly available CDC data on vaccines and cases. I mean, it's rather extraordinary.
Yeah. And also, let's just be really clear, like up until now, one of the reasons that people have ignored all of these Twitter file stories is their argument has been, well, you know, there's not really any proof that government was coercing anyone at Twitter or making them do anything. And this was a company that was just voluntarily making these decisions, working voluntarily with government. Well, we just had a piece in the op-ed pages of the Wall Street Journal of some litigation of some evidence that came out in litigation of the Biden director of a digital media, this guy named Rob Flaherty, basically just outright telling Facebook, get with the program or you're going to have a real problem. And by the way, this is a government that has the ability to regulate, to tax, to fine, to penalize. And essentially, I mean, yes, they were threatening them. Do what we tell you to do. And this had to do with the realm of health information. They in particular wanted a number of doctors who were arguing that natural immunity might mean that you don't need a vaccine. That was not the government view at the time. And they wanted it taken down.
And indeed succeeded in having it taken down.
That's
right. In fact, one part I read, Twitter files 11 and 12, you know, one time, one agency finally, among the dozens of all these agencies in there, you know, pushing for censorship and even pushing to promote accounts that they liked so that they're manipulating opinion. But this one agency, GEC, Global Engagement Center of the State Department, goes in there with a list of 5,500 accounts that they think are sympathetic to the Chinese government and they're ruining COVID-19 information or something. And finally, Twitter says, no, we don't do that. And they finally stand up to it. And then the reason you find out is because the agency was too Trumpy. It was kind of promoting Pompeo's agenda. And so the politics went in there. So it's going to take Republicans then, at least as a starter, to investigate this. And you had a column a week ago about this saying, hey, they're going to be doing this. So what's going to happen? What's the latest on that?
Yeah. So this finally got settled as part of the speaker's fight last week, the drama. And we're going to have a new subcommittee. It's going to be seated within the Judiciary Committee. So it'll ostensibly be under the ownership of Jim Jordan, who is quite an experienced investigator in Congress. And it's going to be on the weaponization of government. And this is going to be a huge aspect of it, is looking at the degree to which government agencies were working with social media companies to censor Americans or to feed their own form of information or disinformation. I mean, but it's also going to look at things like the Trump-Russia collusion hoax and how all that got there. It's going to look at the Hunter Biden laptop story and questions of whether or not the FBI was also working with social media there to deep six that story in the run up to the election, engaging in politics. I mean, that'll be the broad theme, is government agencies essentially incorrectly and inappropriately engaging in politics or leveraging their ability to use private companies to impinge on American freedoms.
Right. Well, when government comes and requests a business to do something, you've got to wonder whether a request is ever really a request, given the power they have over every business in terms of regulation, especially over the largest businesses and the big tech platforms that they were going after. Now, do you think, though, that this Republican majority in the House doing this investigation, are they serious about this, or is this just looking for fodder to use against the Democrats in the 2024 elections? Will we see real reform come out of this?
So I do think that they are very serious about this. And, you know, look, there's already some discussions about ways in which this can be done. I do think it's notable that they have put this inside of the Judiciary Committee because to go to your point, Dennis, if you have a special select committee, which is the way the January 6th committee was set up, don't have the ability to create legislation on their own. There's no authority to do that. So they can come up with recommendations and then send it to other committees of jurisdiction. But when you have it within the Judiciary Committee, they did that purposely because they hope to act on whatever they find.
Now, why is it Judiciary and not this House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence that I believe is chaired by none other than Adam Schiff?
It's not chaired by Adam Schiff anymore.
That's wonderful.
And in fact, it sounds as though Adam Schiff is not even going to get his seat on the Intelligence Committee. McCarthy's going to bar him from sitting there. I think this makes more sense, again, because if you think about it, the things that they're going to be looking at are government abuses of American civil liberties. And that really is a judiciary question type sort of issue, because it'll be there that they also deal with things like, they might not directly do it themselves, but things like if you needed to change surveillance laws and stuff, there's a legal component to all of that. And there's a judicial aspect to it. So that's why it's being done.
One wonders if the government should be allowed to identify specific accounts, go after them, request that they be muzzled, which itself to me violates the First Amendment, with an ex parte without the other side being able to say, well, wait a minute, I'm just quoting publicly available data. I oppose this. You know, it would be interesting to see if they can do that. If Jim Jordan's going to be the star on the big committee, is there a second person who's going to be leading the actual investigation and doing most of the day-to-day? And do you know who that is?
That is undecided. That is a big topic of discussion, because this committee will obviously be populated by other members of the Judiciary Committee, and they haven't filled out who all's got their committee assignments yet. So we know that Jim Jordan's running the Judiciary Committee, but we don't know who else the Republicans are going to be or the Democrats are going to be, because they'll have some seats on this committee too.
Well, as a matter of fact, I wish that this, instead of being a Republican crusade, could be somewhat bipartisan. I wish that, is it Ro Khanna? Is that his name?
Ro Khanna.
One, you guys did a really nice interview with him on the op-ed pages, I believe one weekend or something, because I read you guys every day. Let me tell you some folks, if you'll read even just three articles from the three pages of the op-ed pages of the journal, you will be smarter and you will be able to defeat your friends in debates at cocktail parties. So, but one wonders, is there a way to get some Democrats involved in this so that it's more bipartisan?
Well, we ought to have more guys like Ro Khanna. And, you know, one of the things I loved about Ro Khanna is he pushed back against Twitter in the wake of their decision to on the Donald Trump ban. And he said, look, you know, this is a big decision and you guys really need to think hard about this. And one of the points that he has made, and I agree with this, is one of the stunning questions about Twitter and Facebook and all these guys is not just how easily they agreed to have the government tell them what to do, but that they had not spent any conceivable time with a team of lawyers coming up with a concrete notion of free speech and how they would handle that on their platforms. I mean, we live in a country that has the greatest jurisprudence, 200 plus years of some of the smartest people in the world talking about free speech and where the lines are. And this didn't even seem to be a discussion inside of Twitter or Facebook. And instead they just like, yeah, DHS, tell us what you want us to do.
Yeah, they were so supplicant and so submissive and so wanting to get along. And one wonders that if instead had been the Trump administration really clamping down on everything the way the Democrats were doing in there in Twitter, would they have then stood up and turned it into a bigger public issue? Because, you know, when I was a reporter, I was dying for prior restraint from government, okay? I was dying to get on and write about it and then crusade about it and bring attention to myself. And these tech guys instead just rolled right over.
I know. Yeah, and that's why, look, you would think, and I would hope, that there would be some bipartisan buy-in to your question. Because, look, if a Biden administration can do it to Twitter, a future Trump administration or a future Republican administration could do it to Democrats. And, you know, because then they're the ones that are going to hold the levers of power in Washington and the threats of retribution. And so you'd think that Democrats would think about that. You think that Democrats, who at least historically had a big issue with government surveillance and government censorship, would care about this. You know, so I'd like to keep my fingers crossed. But honestly, the sad thing is that a lot of these civil libertarian groups no longer care about this stuff. They're too involved in politics. I mean, where's the ACLU?
Yes, the ACLU, which once defended neo-Nazis' right to march in Skokie, Illinois, and which today would be happy to throw away the key. It's a sad thing to say. You know, I was talking to a veteran tech guy who's done some work with the CIA, and he says, my gosh, the more you read about the Twitter files, where you can read about it rarely, and people, please check out my columns on truthdow.news and Newsmax. He says, this looks so much like a classic CIA PSYOPs operation. And he says, and it looks as if when you look, I believe I read somewhere 80 ex-intelligence agency employees inside Twitter. What the hell? Why was that ever a good idea? What do you think about this idea that it looks as if the CIA has been in there using it as a major tool for years without our knowledge?
Yeah, the CIA, by the way, just to elaborate on your point too, you know, the notion that the general counsel, you know, former FBI general counsel Jim Baker was over at Twitter making a bunch of these decisions. And so, you know, and having all those contacts and links, that's probably—
And involved in which documents got shown to the reporters who are doing the Twitter file. He was clearly censoring it from the start. In fact, I think they're still shadow banning. I'm certain, because I only get 2 or 3 retweets out of my 8,000 followers, which is just a tragedy.
No, well, and by the way, everyone listening, you must go read all Dennis's writings on this, because he's covered this more than pretty much all the newspapers put together. So that has been really important. But no, the CIA aspect of this is very terrifying. Okay, you know, just think about this, like step back for a second. Imagine that we found out that like major branches of the intelligence agencies and the FBI were having weekly meetings with the Washington Post, or the New York Times, or the Wall Street Journal, and influencing what they wrote and how they wrote it and how things were covered. I mean, people would be shocked, rightly shocked, and, you know, perhaps never read those newspapers again, because you know what that sounds like? It sounds like Pravda. Okay. This is what authoritarian governments do with their media outlets, right? So how was it any different that they were working? I mean, I understand there are some differences, newspapers, et cetera, and that's not exactly what social media is. But to the extent that social media is also using it to tweet around articles from different outlets, how does this not equal a kind of a similar level of scary government involvement? And then you enter the CIA in there too, and then it's
In fact, even worse so, because Twitter is the premier media platform of our age. It is how, you know, the New York Times, with its national circulation, can reach hundreds of millions of people around the world, potentially. And that is why government intelligence agencies have gone after it. And one wonders, imagine if we'd never learned about this at all. Thank goodness for Elon Musk, an adopted American hero. Kim Strassel,
this is a great place to break it. I hope you can come back on and update us. And I hope those Republicans will stick to this. This is a great conversation, and I thank you so much. Have a glorious day. Kim Strassel, Wall Street Journal.
Thanks, Dins.
All right, and it's time for a special guest. I want to really find out about market outlook from a true pro. Jim Yorio is a sage veteran trader, something like 35 years. He's with TJM Institutional Services. You remember this guy from CNBC. He'd be talking from the pits of the Chicago Board of Trade. And just the other day in the Wall Street Journal on the front page, big, big story on how options trading, a flurry of options trading, is very hot this year as people try to catch up to all of this volatility and the plunging stock prices. So, Jim, thank you for being with us. Now, we just finished one of the worst years for stocks. Seems like every time the market could guess right or for upside or downside, it went to downside. Do you feel like, just from the broad big picture first, is that feeling changing, that Eeyore attitude?
Well, there's no question in my mind it's changing. Remember then, when you look at 2022, part of the Fed's game plan was to destroy demand through higher rates and through destroying actual wealth. I mean, their plan was to knock the froth out of the stock market, to knock the $3 trillion cryptocurrency market. That was really what they wanted to do. And it's hard for people to get their head. What's that?
Mission accomplished. Yeah, right.
Yeah, absolutely. Mission accomplished. So yeah, that's what they wanted to do. So now they're in a bit of a gray area here, where they realize that all the rate hikes that they've instituted since March, there's a lag effect to feeling their full effect. And right. We all know that. So the question is that we're just beginning to feel it now. So I think the Fed can talk tough about going forward and raising rates, but I do think that they're getting a little scared to continue with their foot, the pedal to the metal. And the market believes that too. I'm not just giving my opinion. The fact that the yield curve is inverted and the fact that the Fed funds curve is pricing in eases this year. But anyway, I'm ranting already, and you've just had me on your show for a minute. I think the worst for the stock market is over, and I don't think 2023 is going to be as bad as 2022. I think it's going to be better.
There's a clincher right there, ladies and gentlemen. Jim Yorio says, I think the worst for the stock market is over. And, you know, we had a guest on here just a week ago, Ed Butowski, who also feeling kind of bullish. In fact, he thinks clarity happens by March 6th, he's decided. Well, now you are the host of this podcast, The Futures?
The Futures Edge, it's called. It's a weekly podcast, usually macroeconomic, but sometimes we slip into different guests too. Like next week, we're having Dr. Robert Malone. You're familiar with him, the inventor of the mRNA vaccine. And I mean, we'll rope that into markets somehow, but we know we're pushing the envelope a little bit, but it's pretty fun.
Okay. And I think there's more popular interest in options and futures trading than ever before. I think that's potentially risky because, you know, you guys can lose or make an awful lot of money in a matter of microseconds. How is this kind of improving attitude on stocks that you're seeing and hoping for, how is it helping or hurting the options market? And what's going on there in options?
So what you point out is really interesting. And options are a very, very powerful tool. And you said you can, you know, lose quite a bit of money. And of course you can. But I always, every stump speech I give about options is that they are like the power tool that's hanging in your shed. If you know how to use them correctly, mitigate risk, you can build a garage a lot faster. If you don't know how to use them, somebody's going to lose a hand. And that's what options are. So hopefully just people learn to use them before you go out and do it. Now, that being said, I think the proliferation of options, particularly in the retail market, has changed things quite a bit. Like, I think people now represent longs and shorts in options where they never used to. So when we look at things like corrections, we always wanted to see this, you know, this absolute capitulation at the end of a correction or a bear market. I'm not sure. And again, I'm not putting out this huge theory here, but I think it might be clouded a little bit by people who put trades on, go long, and then also have put protection. And God forbid, I know most retail traders probably don't hedge themselves as well as they should, but there probably are some that do. And the fact that people have a lot of options on and represent with call spreads or have puts to cover longs, maybe that takes the most panicky part of a down move out of the stock market. Does that make sense, Dennis?
Yeah, and it could actually help quell some of the volatility because the downside won't be as much because they're actually kind of hedged in some way. The journal story mentioned this glut of of put options. Now, a put option is the right to sell a stock. So if the stock's trading at 20, but you have a piece of paper that says I can sell it to a buyer at 30, that piece of paper then trades and it's worth far more money than even the rise in the stock price. Mm-hmm. But they say that there's this flurry where because stocks have surprised to the upside so early this year, they've got a lot of options that are in the money, put options. I've got the right, or is it the other way around? Anyway, my idea is this glut of put options that are in the money, they're really profitable right now. Is it going to make the prices go up or down in response once I start to take profit on those put options?
So what we're talking about is what we call a gamma squeeze. And when you hear these option traders talk about that, it's just a fancy way of saying something that's a very simple concept. So let's take away the puts, let's say the calls first, because the market has rallied. So a lot of people had sold calls, and they do this to represent a short position or to hedge a long position. But let's just say the ones that have sold calls to represent a short position. Now, all of a sudden, the market starts out. This is the level of their calls. It goes through it, and you start losing more and more money. Now, the only thing you can do then is start buying the underlying to hedge your short call position. Oh, so right. A gamma squeeze is the same as like a short squeeze in futures and in markets, but it's just throwing in the extra layer of options. So then the market gets pushed higher based on however many short calls people are. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. But now apply it to this glut of puts.
So the puts part of it, there's not a gamma squeeze of puts. So like if people were long these puts and all of a sudden the market goes through them to the downside, they keep making more and more money the time it goes. When they go to cover those puts, it puts a floor on the market and they haven't yet. So the only thing that could be a gamma squeeze is if the people are short tons of puts and the market comes back through those and long side, now all of a sudden they have to sell the market to satisfy that position. But if you're short a bunch of puts and you didn't want to get long at that spot to begin with, then to hell with you. You're supposed to lose all your money. A fool and his money are soon to part. Okay. And it's just a dumb maneuver. And call me. I'll tell you how to do it a little bit better.
All right. So I just went down into those weeds. Let me kind of pull back up and just let's look at the Fed, because I remember in 08, 09, I'm on CNBC every day as an anchor. And it's one of the first times in my financial career I've actually been truly afraid for the markets. It felt really scary. And we've just had our worst year since then. And, you know, it never felt that scary as it did way back then. So this is just a Fed. This is just a matter of the Fed. But isn't it true that the Fed cannot keep raising? Where do you think rates top out? I feel like they have to turn around because one reason is government debt. Our government debt is now costing us over $1 trillion a year because of the higher interest rates. That's up from $350 billion a year. And yet the Fed can't bankrupt the government. If they were to go to 10% like they did in the 80s, we'd be bankrupted as a government. So isn't that a natural limit on Fed rate hikes, Jim Yorio?
Of course it is. It's a natural limit because you can't. Then it would just be this awful situation if the federal government had to keep borrowing more and more money to service their debt, because God forbid they'd ever stop spending and borrowing less. That's never going to happen. So of course, it's primarily the government debt that needs to be rolled. But think about it, in all kinds of other places throughout different levels of the economy, also debt needs to be rolled. From short-term debt needs to be rolled from those low rates that we had 9 months ago into the higher rates now. That's right. When I said before about the being a long time before you start feeling the effects. So yes, the Fed has probably hiked too much already. Do I think they're going to go another 25 basis points at the February meeting? Absolutely, they're going to do that. They have to keep talking tough right up until the point they capitulate.
But only 25. And 25 basis points will be down from 50, which was down from four rate hikes of 75 basis points, 3/4 of a full percentage point in a row. I mean, how they can hope for a soft landing when they knee-jerk so suddenly and so reacted. Now, there's a second factor, I feel like, that's also tamping down Fed rates and why the market already is betting that rates are going to come down rather than continue to rise ad nauseum. And that is because I think the Fed is a political animal. I think it wants Biden reelected. No U.S. president, I think I'm right on this, has ever been reelected in a recession year. So they have to get the rate hikes out of the way and pause and then start to ease in time for it to help the recession in the election year of 2024 to help the economy.
First of all, how dare you suggesting the Fed is political, except for the fact, perhaps, that the two times that Jerome Powell pivoted to hawkish was essentially the day after his appointment was confirmed. That whatever two different levels of appointment he had, it was literally the next day or week where he flipped into hawkish. So to suggest that they're political animals, of course they are. And I don't even think this is necessarily even a big bash anymore. Everybody protects their job. That's why the Fed doesn't work, because there is so many more things, so many more inputs to these people than there should be. And right. That's why they swing like this wild pendulum that goes back and forth. And do I think they'll take their foot off the gas to try to help get a president elected? I think that is perfectly reasonable to assume that. So absolutely. And anyone who points at us and says that's ridiculous, I don't think they even understand basic psychology. Of course, it's a possibility.
Yes, because the Fed is just a bunch of human beings, okay? And they want to be liked and loved too out there.
Yep.
Right?
Yes,
we're heading around Jim Yorio for the last lap here. So a couple of things just in terms of segments, if you have any thoughts, and if not, fine. But first of all, interesting, last year, growth stocks sucked, wind and value stocks, which are usually slower growth and kind of boring, they gained vastly more than growth stocks. What happens to that balance this year, you figure? Does it go back to the way it was?
Well, that depends. So the growth stocks in the NASDAQ, I think in the second half of the year, if rates really start to head lower, could do very, very well. Since early October, I've given three different speeches where my theme has been metals, copper predominantly, and gold and silver. I think that sector is going to do the best. I'm wildly overweight copper. They're almost irresponsible. And by the way, when I say that, I am a risk mitigator by nature. I'm not going to go broke, nor am I going to be a 10 billionaire from trading. So it's a big position for me in copper, gold, and silver, and platinum. I think those are the good spots. But to your question, you definitely asked about growth versus value. I think the first quarter of the year, while the stock market could still trade back and forth and be kind of in a tactical range, I think value may outperform. But as soon as rates stabilize and start to head lower, I think growth will too. I think either way, my pick, and again, I don't tell people what to do, but I do answer questions about what I'm doing. My pick is still metals, and I like copper, gold, silver, and platinum more than anything.
Okay. And also, although gold usually is an investment you make in bad times as an offset against stock decline, so you're actually looking at industrial production going up if you're investing in copper, right? You feel like that's coming back. All right, and then talk to us about bonds, because bonds sucked. I mean, Butowski on here talked about it was only the second time in 100 years that bonds fell with stock prices instead of going up against stock price falling. And now there's been a bond rally this year. And again, you say, isn't it because people feel like the Fed's going to start easing back on rate increases?
I do. And I think that bonds are probably the right place to be. I just mentioned in October, the first was the New Orleans Investment Conference. And I was sitting next to Peter Bookfire, and he's talked about buying 2 years. And it didn't even dawn on me. It like struck me as so odd that someone would buy 2 years for a yield, but this is the new world we're in now. It's just going to take away years of thinking that you buy bonds for either price appreciation or price depreciation and buy or sell. So I do think people are going to buy bonds because of the attractive yields right now. And I think the Fed is going to start talking a lot easier in the coming months. So I do like it. I like shorter end more just because they'll move, they're higher rates right now, and they'll move quicker if the Fed starts talking about a pivot.
All right. You know what? I think we're going to wrap it there. Jim Yorio, thank you so much. Host of the Futures Edge podcast and with TJM. Hey, man, it was great to see you, and let's talk more. Please come back. All right.
Please do. Thank you, Dennis. Day.
The Biden administration is constantly finding new ways to fail and then blaming others for it, except when it is intentionally failing on issues like the border and energy policy. Well, we're not going to let them get away with that. I'm Greg Corumbus. Join Jim Garrity of National Review and me each weekday for the 3 Martini Lunch podcast. We'll give you the good, bad, and crazy news of the day and lots of laughs, too. Find us right here on the Ricochet Audio Network at ricochet.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now for today's parting shot. It's the new year. It's the time for making changes in your life that can make it better. So I want to talk to you about a couple of things. And I was thinking about high school reunions. And if you've ever been to yours, You know the real reason? It's to see how much better or worse everyone else looks than you do. It's weird, but your 50s, this can be a matter of life and death. I mean, you go to the reunion, we are all 17 or 18 years old at the same time, and you return decades later, and some of us look so much worse, and others look so much better than the others. So why is that? It's not genetics. Genetics play only a 7% role in our health outcomes. That's what the experts say. 93% of our health and our longevity is shaped by lifestyle factors. Sleep, nutrition, exercise, stress levels, depression or the lack of it, all of these things can have an incredible impact on your longevity. And for me, the compelling point is, especially as this new year beckons, the compelling point is that even for people who have made bad choices for decades, you still have time to help yourself and heal thyself. We can eat better. We can eat in a different way. I spoke to you in an earlier episode on Parting Shot about my 16-8 regimen, where I eat only 8 hours a day and fast for 16. We've got to exercise more and sleep longer. You can reduce the risk of getting some of the most dreaded diseases known to mankind. And so this idea of food, exercise, and sleep, it's kind of a longevity triad, all right? This kind of three legs to the stool, food, exercise, and sleep. And today I want to talk to you about the easiest element of these three, and that is sleep. Now, all three factors play an important role in reducing inflammation in the body, and that is the immune system's primitive first line of defense. It can run haywire and create all kinds of health problems. This is according to Dr. Rudolf Tanzi of Harvard University, a neuroscientist there. Various studies have shown us that if you sleep less than 8 hours a night, this increases the risk of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, obesity, hypertension. It reduces your immune system response and the body's ability to defend itself. Think of that, all because you're not sleeping well. Now you can even reduce your risk of getting Alzheimer's disease by getting 7 or 8 hours of sleep each night. This is proven by medical data. And Dr. Tanzi of Harvard says that get that 8 hours, even if it isn't all at once. Take naps, rack up that total. This is because the brain relies on some street sweeper cells to keep it kind of clean. And these cells are called glial cells, G-L-I-A-L. Now these glial cells come out, street sweepers, and they clean out the plaques in the brain that can cause the brain to lose cells. These cells die, and as they die, the brain thinks it's under attack, and so this triggers inflammation in the brain. And these glial cells, though, they only come out when we sleep, and they only come out when we are in REM sleep, rapid eye movement, when you are dreaming. So if you want a recommendation for how to sleep better, the easiest thing is simply drink less alcohol. Save it for the weekends only, or avoid alcohol entirely. Studies show that when you drink just 2 drinks a night, it reduces your sleep quality by 24%. If you have 3 or more drinks in a night, it reduces your sleep quality by 40%. And that is quite an impact. Overall, alcohol consumption can increase the risk of constructive sleep apnea by 25%. And I've had that constructive sleep apnea for many years. I use a CPAP machine. It's a living hell. So if you have just 1 drink before bed, it can lead to heavy snoring, even in people who don't usually snore. So all of us have to work harder on sleeping better and sleeping longer, because it will make your health better, it will make your life better, it will make your mood better, and it will mend your brain. That's as good a reason as any that I can think of to take a nice lazy nap this weekend on a long afternoon. I hope you have a great one. Have a glorious day.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.